podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Vicky Fleetwood and you're listening to the Mall Over Rugby Podcast.
Good evening, sports fans. This is not an official comeback, but maybe a little one just for now, and we'll see how the weekend goes. This is the Mall Over Podcast. We are still the only rugby podcast to give you none of the news, views and opinions on any of the rugby action, all with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter. We are at Mall Over Podcast, Mall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook. And all of our podcasts and back catalogue can be found on the Sports Podcast Network. We're back for, as I say, 1 week only by popular demand. And by popular demand, I mean the seven other people other than us that are in our rugby WhatsApp group who have been clamouring for a Mall Over podcast. And we thought, why not give the fans what they want and a bit of opinion on the World Cup, as we have found it so far through different experiences. We've had some people working there. We've had some visitors. We've had some people just sat on their asses, not doing a goddamn thing. You'll be pleased to know that this week I am joined by a full house of conglomerate. So we have got cameraman extraordinaire, freshly back from France, where he's been on camera seven, Doug, Chinese Lensman Andrews. How you doing, mate?
I'm all right. Camera 13, actually, mate. I just, you know, how many other podcasts out there can say that they can name every one of their listeners individually?
The Long Snapper.
Long Snapper, definitely.
In fact,
more hosts than listeners.
Well, their listeners got less as they've incorporated more hosts.
Law of diminishing returns, isn't it, really? Why do a podcast? Just get together and do a Zoom. Everyone's listening.
Anyway, I'm also, as you might have heard in the background there, the nicest man ever to appear on a Cornish Rugby podcast, Ben Eustace. How you doing, Ben?
Yeah, pleased to be on Britain's best six-monthly rugby podcast.
It's an absolute
pleasure.
That's
not pleasure. What you said in WhatsApp last night.
I was going to say, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to have convinced you to come out of podcast in retirement, because you did not seem very keen last night.
Do I seem keen now?
I've seen people more keen to go to bloody IKEA on a Saturday.
I think, Ben, it's probably more to do with the fact that you may have foreseen where this podcast may end up, but we will do our best.
I've seen your tweets for the last 18 months, mate.
I still try and keep it civil, but let's be fair, I've been doing a lot of trolling on the Mall Over account recently, and it's fun. It is fun. Did anybody see the 5 Meter channel today do their England trolling? Was that in the WhatsApp as well, where they've put like 10 England players on the on their combined England South Africa team just to troll a load of South Africans? And it's delicious. Anyway, before we move on, I better introduce the housewife's favorite, because that's who everyone's here to see as well. Freshly back from Marseille, where he's been sunning himself on the south of France. How you doing, Phil Farm Vet?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm glad everybody's here to see me on this audio podcast. They're going to be a bit disappointed, aren't they?
I could take some photos, mate. It's not a problem. We can share. We can share all those.
Were you actually in Marseille, Phil?
I was, yeah.
Oh, mate, you should have said. I had no idea. I could have directed you towards Cassis, and you'd have had a much better time.
I had a pretty good time.
Well, I'm sure you did, but that place is probably one of my favourite places in Europe. So there you go.
So let's get on to some rugby chat before, you know, this free Zoom ends, because I'm not paying for it. Phil, you've been there as a fan, this Rugby World Cup, a couple of times, a couple of separate trips, more money than sense, some might say. How have you found it?
Yeah, I suppose the first thing to say is the reason I could go a couple of times is because I bought the tickets 3 years ago when the draw was made, and paid for them then, which meant that I didn't have to tell my wife why I was spending so much money now. So, yeah, went out for England, Argentina and Scotland, South Africa. And to be fair, Marseille is an absolutely lovely city. Lots to see, really nice people. My expectations were kind of tarnished by the England game in the Euros, where the Russian ultras came in and there was all the big riots. And I was expecting it to be a bit fruity. None of that at all. Cracking city, well worth a trip. The organisation of the World Cup, however, was an absolute shit show. So they've known for a long time there's going to be 60,000 people turning up in Marseille for two separate nights next to each other. Two entrances to the stadium, a north and a south. All of the roads run along the south side. No signs anywhere. You've got 60,000 people trying to get through 10 turnstiles.
And they're all in bloody French.
Yeah. Not fortunately, I was there with my friend who knew that there was a north entrance, so we took a few little back roads, got to the north entrance 40 minutes before kickoff. There are 12 people there on turnstiles waiting to, or mocked up turnstiles waiting to scan tickets, and not a single person going through. We literally walked straight up to them, nobody else there, straight in through, on you go. They then have bars with one tap, four people serving. So obviously no ability to keep up with the quantity of beer being requested. Ran out of beer before halftime, ran out of all official stash on the Scotland-South Africa game before the kickoff. So there's people queuing up at the official stash stands. Oh, can I get one of those T-shirts? Oh, no, we haven't got any of those left. What about one of those? No, I haven't got any of those. What have you got? We've got pin badges. That was literally the only thing they had left to sell was pin badges before kickoff. Just so, an absolute...
So wonderfully French.
Farce. Oh, no. Oh, but can I have that one?
Wonderfully World Rugby.
We've got some of these World Rugby cravats. Rugby World Cup 2023 cravat and World matching
rugby
beret.
Branded, faded, pastel-coloured chinos.
Yeah.
I was like, can I have that one that's hung up there then, please? Oh, no, we're not allowed to sell them. They're for display. What, who are you displaying them to? There's nothing to sell.
We displayed them to you, then, Phil. You just couldn't have it.
And then was back there this weekend for the England game, but watched the other three games from a bar. And yeah, completely different. Signs from a mile out telling you where to go, pushing half the people north, half the people south. Didn't run out of beer. We turned up, there was probably 1,000 beers there ready poured, ready to be handed out. About 20 people going around for each entrance with little backpacks full of beer, with little taps to top you up. Just a much smoother experience. But like, how could they not have worked this out before the first game? It was, yeah, it was from the ridiculous to the sublime. Much better experience.
You think they would have worked some of that shit out when, you know, Marseille play at home, or they have other... You know, maybe have a couple of France games there in the lead up to the tournament. Go, oh, how are we going to make this work?
Well, but it wasn't.
They basically kick out the owner of the stadium.
But it wasn't just that. It was like the organisation of public transport. On the first weekend, there was no metro running at all. They closed it because there were too many people trying to get on, so they shut it and said, "Sod it, you lot can walk." And it was fine because it was only like 2 miles out of the middle of town. But then on when we're back this weekend, there's a little stand just outside the stadium with about 200 little electric scooters and bikes. So we just went straight back out, scam on with your phone on the scooter, cane it back to the bar well in advance of the South Africa France game.
Fantastic.
But no, it was really good fun. I would recommend it.
I'm glad. And Doug, you were out there for the early part on visuals.
Yeah, I went out early doors until the group stage finished. So my last game, I think, was Scotland against Ireland in Paris.
You mentioned Cassis.
Well, we had a few days off in between finishing in Nice and going back to Toulouse. We had like 5 days off, and or 4 days off, whatever. I can't remember. Whatever. So me and a pal, the options were that HBS, the organisers of the broadcast element of the World Cup, put on a coach to drive the 5.5 hour car journey from Nice to Toulouse, which turned into a 9 hour coach journey.
Absolutely.
At 10 o'clock in the morning, after finishing our game at, I think, like 1 a.m. So me and my pal Dave decided we were going to hire a car. We'd spend the night in this little sleepy little town called Cassis, which was beautiful. And then sort of mosey back the following day, did a bit of sea fishing, cliff jumping, all that kind of jazz, and ended up driving back. Dave has quite a substantially heavy left, right foot. So the drive took about 4 hours. And we missed out on what can only be described as one of the worst experiences in the world, according to other people. So, So like I say, the social side of it was great. Go out, beers most nights. Had a ludicrous night out in Nice. Went way too big.
5 pints.
Realised I'm in my mid-40s the following day while sat on the beach in Nice, which is stones, by the way. Stones. It's not a beach. It's stones. Mortally hungover. The work, I mean, I think I mentioned to you before, Russ, one of the most ridiculous things I've ever experienced did I call you Rich then?
No, you said Russ.
Okay. One of the most ridiculous things I've ever experienced at work was when in 2010 at the South Africa World Cup, we used to play keepy uppy in the car park before the games just to kill a bit of boredom. I remember this busy little twat who was a production manager running around before the game and coming to see us and shouting at us, put the ball away, put the ball away. Sepp Blatter's running around. He won't want to see you dicking about in the car park with a football. It's like, what, the head of world football won't want to see the people that he's paying to shoot the football actually enjoying the game of football. He'll think that's abhorrent, really. The most ridiculous thing I've ever come across in work.
Only
marginally worse than most of the working days I had in France.
Marginally?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll leave that right there.
You know, if any of the rugby brethren want to know about, you know, what happened in France and how my experience with the working side and the sort of inner workings of the Rugby World Cup, hit me up. You know where I am.
There we go.
But you never know who listens to this. Loose lick sim ships, don't they, Russ?
They absolutely do. They absolutely do. Ben, from the comfort of your sofa and probably a corner of the Cornishman, how have you found the Rugby World Cup so far?
It's almost been like a bit of a throwback, I think, because the last few World Cups, the Tier 2 nations have sort of uniformly done quite well. Well, that's my memory of it. This one seems like one from sort of 20 years ago where a few of the teams that have turned up have just got a complete assing every week, which I think is a shame. You know, you've obviously got the exceptions to the rule, like Portugal, but, you know, your Chile's and Romania's, I'm not sure what good it's doing them. So, you know, there's a few games. Yeah, Italy. Yeah. There's a few games I haven't bothered watching just because, you know, what's the point? You gets to 28-0 after 10 minutes and there's not much point watching it. I did watch Italy against New Zealand because that was just like a car crash, wasn't it? But, you know, dotted amongst those games, there's been some real classics, which has, you know, been just great to watch. But it's too long, isn't it, as well, the tournament. And you know, I wasn't well organised enough to get out to France and probably wouldn't have done anyway. So,
I had my missus.
Had some beers for some games, had some coffee, some crisps. Oh,
lovely. How very Parisian. Very continental. Yeah. Did you have a baguette? Dry baguette.
I think I might have had at least one baguette during the tournament. Yeah, for sure.
I never want to see a baguette ever again.
my missus said to me, obviously she'd seen on the socials that Phil was in France, and her words to me were, how come you didn't go to the Rugby World Cup in France? And I'm like, are you fucking for real? As if you would have sanctioned that trip. And she was like, oh yeah, well, you know, you usually do what you want anyway.
Making out like he's our Dumbai. I've never known a bloke less under the thumb than Russell Milson. Plays cricket every fucking weekend.
There you go.
I think, yeah.
He's about 50 rounds of golf a month.
He'd have had to swap around a golf for a trip to France. There's still tickets available for the semi-finals now. There were 4,500 empty seats at the quarterfinals.
I can imagine. There's plenty of empty seats. They would have been filled in green shirts.
My thoughts about some of the tier two stuff, coming back to what Ben said. I've watched pretty much every match. Some of those tier two games, I don't think the score accurately reflected the gameplay. It was just New Zealand or South Africa or whoever were absolutely clinical. Whenever they got a chance, they scored a try. But some of the scrums, rucks, mauls, general gameplay was far closer than the scores allowed, other than Italy, who were just absolutely shocking. Didn't really deserve to be there.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? Like, the tier two nations, the real tier two nations, and I think that we have to differentiate slightly, the likes of Fiji, Samoa were decent in parts, but the actual proper tier two nations, your Chiles, your Uruguays, Romania, they Portugal, they've actually got some very decent skills. They've got some half decent little set moves. They've got some little surprises up their sleeve. What they lack is any sort of fitness and experience in playing this level.
When everyone lost their minds about England beating Chile, they conveniently forgot for the first 20 minutes it was 0-0 and Fiji and Chile were playing really well. Yeah. But they're a bunch of plumbers, so they soon ran out of gas, unfortunately. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but that's what happens. That's what's always happened, and these teams have often put up a fight. South Africa beat someone and they scored after like 30 seconds, and if they get that early score, that if the big team gets the early score, it's a procession from that minute. If the tier two nation, I can't remember who it was, didn't they kept France to 0-0 for 20 minutes? One of them kept, might have been Uruguay.
Uruguay, was it?
Yeah, and they did the same to, someone did the same to New Zealand as well for the first sort of 15, 20 minutes. And then the class and the fitness and the, you know, just the organisation shows. And that's always been a thing. We've already mentioned the team that surprised me the most with how shit they were Italy. And I don't know whether that was something to do with Kieran Crowley. I know he's left his job now.
I mean, going into a World Cup with a totally demotivated coach is not going to be the best preparation.
They were so bad, though. Like, so bad. He took Lamaro off in that final game against France, and he just after half time. And it just stank of the players just going, "You're a cunt, mate. We're not into this at all." And they just fucked it off. Really, really frustrating. But what I wanted to talk about briefly around the tier two nations is at what point. So we've got four groups of five teams. So we've got a 20 team World Cup. I know there's talk of extending that to a 24 team World Cup at the next one. I don't know if you guys have heard that. But at what point do they have the World Rugby? And I have to say, actually, we've got all of these people in one location for a fucking insane amount of time. once the group stages are finished, why not give some of these tier two nations some sort of plate competition? The stadiums are there, the people are there. Why not, you know, the referees are there. Why not create a little plate competition that runs in line with the cup competition? Have the final on the same day, have like a double header final, all of that sort of stuff. In fact, you could play all of the games as double headers in that stadium. If you've got the stadium there anyway, why not?
Well, one thing, let's not be promoting double headers. Yeah. Let's sack the double headers off, right?
Okay, mate. Yeah, sorry about that. Two different locations. You don't want more than one game.
Don't want
a day.
Two games in one place on one day because they'll, you know, I'll have to do two games in one day, and I don't want to do that. I don't understand the need to expand. I think there's not enough quality in the tournament as is. There's not enough interest in the tournament as is. Expanding it's just going to create a load more matches that nobody gives a shit about. It's not going to create better matches, is it?
No.
What it will do, it will guarantee that if you expand it to 24, that's what...
It'd be six fours, eight, wouldn't 16, it?
16, 8, 16, 20. It's six groups of four, right?
Yeah, it'd be six fours, yeah.
Like the World Cup.
Yeah. Well, the World Cup is 32 teams now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, so six groups of four. That guarantees that the top six make the quarterfinals.
Yeah.
And then the two best runners-up, right? So the top eight teams in the world should get through to the World Cup quarterfinals, which hasn't happened this time because, well, it has, hasn't it?
Technically,
Scotland were the only ones that missed out. I don't see the benefit in doing that. What I see the benefit in is having a... As things stand, the third place teams in the pools get an automatic World Cup spot, right?
I assume so.
So
yes,
why not make, if that's the case, then do one for the fourth place teams, and the winners of that little sub tournament get a place in the World Cup.
Yeah.
But just expanding it and bringing a load more shit teams in does nothing for anyone.
Well, because that's all it is. The only teams that aren't in the World Cup are the teams that are too shit to get into the World Cup.
Yeah.
You know, it's the at the moment, you could probably see it's the USA, Canada.
Well, and that's why they want to do it.
Yeah. And whilst telling Tonga that they're not going to be in the World Cup again till at least 2030, which is...
What have I missed there?
Well, I thought that Tonga had there was something about them missing out now until 2030, whether I've read that wrong, but I didn't think that they were going to be included in the qualification. I'll have to read back
what,
on
so
it.
So they're just, what, folding Tonga rugby?
Pretty much. And I'll have to check. I'm going to have to check it.
That can't be right, can it?
Check it in the background.
So the way I see it, there's two issues there that are being conflated. One is that there's too much of a gap between your teams ranked 17 to 24 and your teams ranked 1 to 4 or 1 to 8, that the games just end up not being enjoyable. And then the second is how spread out the World Cup's been. And I think they've got different solutions. One is the teams towards the lower end need to play teams above them more frequently. Teams outside the Six Nations and the Rugby Championship need to play teams in the Six Nations and the Rugby Championship more frequently. That's the only way they're going to get any better, which comes back to conversations we've had before about opening up the Six Nations to two tiers and having promotion and relegation and giving people opportunities. But also, another conversation we've had before, Saxons. Saxons going on a tour of, I don't know, Georgia, Romania, Portugal and Spain in the summer would be fantastic for those nations. Great for the guys playing for the Saxons. Would open up more opportunities for them getting to the next stage. Would be better for England rugby. And then the spread out tournament. I think, yeah, it just needs a bit of thought. You could take a week off that group stage with having games almost every day, maybe every day, without teams having to play more frequently than once every 5 days. You can give them four rest days between games. It just requires a bit more thought than going, we're just going to do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and stretch out. And then end of the group stage on the Sunday. Everybody has time off till the Friday, and you go quarterfinals, semifinals, final.
Yeah. In both competitions.
So that kind of leads me to think they don't really want the sort of emerging nations to come through anyway. I sort of agree with Phil. I think there should be a two division, Six Nations at least. And what I would do is have the bottom team from the Six Nations play a one-off playoff with the top team from the second division, probably away at the top team from the second division to give them a good fixture.
Well, you could do it. You could even do it like a two-legged thing, couldn't you? A home and away, make it fair, like the Championship playoff used to be.
Yeah. But I don't know, for the World Cup, I mean, if they're going to have more teams in it, they could almost have like a pre-group with all the, you know, teams below the top eight have a sort of pre-qualifying at the actual stadiums before the tournament. And then it would at least stop them having the issues Phil was having with the beer pumps and transport to the ground and stuff. They could at least use it as a sort of warm-up for the stadium. And then it would at least get rid of the teams that are going to get battered 80-0 every week.
So the only point I disagree with you, Ben, about not wanting emerging nations is there are three that they want. They want the USA, they want Canada, and they want Germany because of the money. The rest of them, they couldn't give a shit about. There is undertones within World Rugby, and I'm sure I've heard it somewhere saying that if they were to expand the Six Nations, it wouldn't be Georgia getting in, it would be Germany. Germany are ranked 32nd in the world, but they have a lot of people there with a lot of money. And that's all World Rugby give a shit about, is lining their own pockets. They don't even care about the legacy of the sport. It's about short-term lining of their own pockets.
Yeah.
My question would be, what's in it for the big nations? And until there's something in it, it's not going to happen.
Sustainability of the sport.
But they're not interested in sustainability, mate, because as long as they get their few fixtures a year, they're sustainable.
Or they perceive themselves to be sustainable.
Yeah, but a fixture against Romania is not going to make them any more sustainable.
Not short term, but longer term, having better competition.
I don't think they're interested, mate. Bigger... The people that are involved are only interested in sustaining their positions for as long as they are in that position.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's looking longer term than the current terms of engagement that they're involved in. It's all about get me through today and we'll worry about tomorrow then.
Yeah, 100%. But that's why we're in the situation we're in now.
But there's no incentive to change it, mate. There is no incentive to change it. Like, I think one of the things that I hadn't really considered until just now when it was said was like the play-in tournament before the World Cup, play it at local rugby grounds rather than these soulless football domes that we go into for every World Cup. Get these, if you want to expand the tournament, get these emerging nations. Why are we having a qualifying tournament in Dubai a year before the World Cup? Why can't we have that qualifying tournament there and then, that week before the World Cup?
I suppose the challenge would be for some of the poorer nations, the fact that they need to then financially commit to being there for the main World Cup, whether they're going to make it or not.
This is something that should be looked at. Why are any of these nations having to subsidise anything to do with being at a World Rugby tournament? That everything should be covered by World Rugby. These teams should be paying for their accommodation to go to a World Cup. The World Cup wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the teams. The teams should be funded to be there.
I agree.
The whole thing to me just seems like, you know, the short term kind of outlook to it all is remarkable, really. But I don't see another way around it because
you're either in the club or you're not.
Yeah, and until there's an incentive for these larger nations to actually you know, actually want these other teams to be involved. I mean, a nation like Scotland would be crazy to actively want Germany to be good at rugby or Spain to actually grow the game and get as many participants and elite level coaching. They'd be mental to want that. Because if they lose that sort of cachet of being a tier one nation and the uniqueness that comes with that, yes, so you'll be dead. Same with Wales.
They should do more with the Lions as well. You know, have have tour games that are, because they're going to go, they'll probably end up playing Western Australia or someone on this tour that they'll beat 100-0. They'd be better off getting Georgia to fly over or Portugal or someone and play them or play them on the way or something.
Mm.
I know they've done that a little bit on this tour already, but the more of that, the better.
I mean,
because the days of being able to go to 12 clubs in South Africa and get a good game out of them are probably over now, aren't they? So just arrange a load of, you know.
They don't need a full test match squad to beat Australia. They're fucking rancid.
Yeah, exactly.
They could play.
If they could play Portugal. It'd probably be a better game.
Well, yeah, you could argue and that poison little fucking horrible little cunny is off to Japan as well now, and he after denying all knowledge of any interview pre World Cup. Let's move away, sorry Russ, I think
we're veering into territory that we didn't want to get into on this. We wanted to talk about the World Cup.
Yeah,
I worry that we're getting into stuff that, you know, everyone knows our position on. I'd rather just...
So that's where I was at. I was going to head us on to England and England's performance so far at the World Cup, and you know how we think they've done in general. Do we think they've actually made strides forward, Ben, throughout the tournament?
I think they have, because where they started was probably a long-term low, wasn't it? I thought the performance against Argentina was excellent. Probably put in about half an hour maybe against Japan that was pretty decent, but the first half was poor, not even counting the Chile game. Fiji was decent in parts, but not great. I think there's been a lot of odd selection calls. It seems mostly just to fit Farrell in some way. I'm not as anti-Farrell as some people, because I think every player that has played with him rates him. But it does seem to be you're moving a lot of people out of position just to fit one player in.
This is the thing with Farrell, though. This is the thing with Farrell, though, isn't it? Right, and I don't doubt that he's an excellent rugby player, and I don't think any of that has ever been in question. But with Owen Farrell, you have to play a certain way, or you have to then not accommodate other people. If you're playing Owen Farrell has to play at 10, has to. It's proven that whilst he can play 12, England are blunt and imaginationless when he plays at 12, because we're so easy to defend. Because you know the ball's going to get to Farrell and stop, or get to Farrell and kick. And the problem with Owen Farrell at 12, again, is that whoever plays at 10 inside him doesn't get to run the game. The 10 doesn't run the game in a way that George Ford would run a game or Marcus Smith would run a game. And the games where Marcus Smith had played 10 with Farrell outside him, he hasn't got hope, because he doesn't get to make those decisions. Now,
go on. And, you know, you had that, they've had the experiment with Smith, and now Smith's got a concussion, so it isn't going to happen again. But New Zealand do that. They've got Bowden Barrett at fullback, but it's completely fluid in terms of probably more than half the time he stood at 10 and someone else has gone back to fullback.
But they wanted Smith to do that. And in the first 15 minutes, It worked. I felt like it. That's exactly what happened. Smith was popping up all over the place, and I get it. And against Fiji, sorry mate, it was almost the ideal time to try that, because his assumption would have been that there would have been more broken field than organized structured defense from Fiji, and I understand the premise of it.
Well, I could see the logic in it as well, because you had Farrell. So if Smith came in to first receiver, you had Farrell, who's played a lot of 12, who could push out. Tuilagi, who's played a lot of 13, who could push out. Marchant, who's played a lot on the wing, who could then move out. And Daly fitting at fullback. But I don't think English players have got the same rugby brains that New Zealand players have got to make it work. And I think I just couldn't see the logic, as I made clear in some of our conversations, because I just think play your best fullback in every game, because you should be playing your best team in every game. But I could see some logic in what they were trying. But it doesn't work for every team. Italy tried it. They moved their good fullback out to the wing and were putting Tommy Allen at fullback, and look how that worked for them. I think New Zealand, it works for them just because of the quality of the two players. And plus, they've got an extra playmaker at the moment with Barrett's brother playing at 12. You know, he's far more of a playmaker than any centre we've got. So it's almost apples and pears.
Phil?
Hey, look, going back to what Ben said, the reason we were great against Argentina is because we got backed into a corner by the early red, and Ford manipulated that game in a way that was perfect for the occasion. And we played possession rugby. We played territory rugby. We weren't that worried about possession. We put them down in the corners. We got them to give away penalties. We scored points, and we kept that scoreboard ticking over. It was a classic. It was a classic kind of old school Sale performance, or even an old school Leicester or Bath performance, to be honest. But we were backed into a corner there. The reason we weren't very good against Samoa was because we tried playing Ford Farrell again. But if you look at the Chile game and you look at the start, probably the first half of the Fiji game, we had Farrell playing with quick ball, going to the line, making flat passes, and it looked good and it made progress. And where we fell down in that Fiji game is we have zero confidence in ourselves and zero ability to get over from 5 yards out. Every time we got the ball and it got slowed down 5 yards out, we just kept trying one-up runners, and big hits came in and we just started going backwards. But actually, the Smith experiment worked for that game. Would it work against any of the other teams who are left in the tournament? Absolutely not. I cannot see it having a 5'8.5" fullback who was a very effective speed hump on Sunday in defence isn't going to work when you've got Villemsa, Dealendi, Creel. They're talking about potentially playing Moody on Saturday, chasing down high kicks coming towards you. He's just going to get absolutely pulverised. And the reality is he's not going to play there anyway. But to me, there's enough green shoots there with Farrell playing 10, playing the ball fast. I would rather see Lawrence than Manu. Marchant playing at 13. That I wouldn't write us off in the semi-final.
I just don't think our pack's good enough, because your key point was the quick ball, but they just don't get quick ball enough. And I just think that against South Africa, they're just going to get beaten up. We've said before, our resources at prop is just bare.
Limited.
Yeah, and, you know...
Bare and not very good.
Yes, exactly. I can't remember if you said this the other day or not, but I think Otaje's playing quite well now. Obviously, Earl's been really good. And I think Laws has been very good as well. I hate myself for saying it, but I think they need to play Billy at 8 just to have an actual number 8. And it's not in any particular sort of reflection on Billy's form, but I think whenever he's come on, they've looked a little bit more solid and have a focal point. I think Kerr has been very good when he's come on. And yeah, I have been impressed by Marchant as well. So, you know, some green shoots, but I don't think they're going to be anything like enough.
See, I think having Billy at eight is the kind of move we would have pulled in 2019, where we're playing South Africa, we have to try and match them at their game. And I think it's the worst thing to do.
I don't actually need to play our game. I agree. I don't actually mind having Billy on the bench. I can just about stomach that. I don't think he's got anywhere near the impact to be that runner from the start. I think if we've got a chance, we need to have a dynamic back row and try and run them around the pitch a little bit.
Imagine how quickly our pack's going to be going backwards in the scrums, though.
Yeah, and I get that point, but I don't think Billy has that much of an impact on that. Doug, you're quite quiet in this. What have you made of it so far from an England perspective?
Well, first and foremost, I think we're dreadful. We don't know what we are, because Borthwick wants to play in a certain way, but we don't have the players to play in that manner. And he seems reticent to actually lean into what we are at the moment, which is a team that needs to basically play South Africa like Japan did in 15. We need to be quicker than them around the park. We need to move them side to side, and we need to just go, we're going to lose up front. We're going to put, like, this England team is so dumb. I can imagine that the first scrum that we get, we hold the ball in the row to try and milk a penalty, and we'll just get put far, like, shoved 30 yards backwards. We're that dumb and arrogant that we think, you know, we'll be able to compete with these people in the scrum. I think Borthwick is so arrogant and believes in his structures and his journey so much that he can't see what the issues are. I don't think Owen Farrell, I mean, I don't know what he does. I don't know what he does to make himself undroppable, because for me, we played our best rugby in that Argentina game, and he was nowhere to be seen. Why would you go from a performance like that, you know, in a must-win game when back's against the wall, everything's against you, put up that performance, win a game, admittedly we didn't play great, but to then go, but Owen Farrell's back now, we don't need to play like that anymore. Owen's back, everything will be all right, Owen's back. It's madness to me. I just don't get it. But in a way, I kind of do get it, because I think successive coaches have just been terrified of what Owen Farrell, like the risk of leaving a fit Owen Farrell out and losing, and everyone going, well, you didn't play Owen Farrell. Because that's what we'll do, right? No one's ever going to go, well, you didn't play George Ford. That's why you lost.
Well, Ford wasn't great in the Japan game. But no, I'm not disagreeing with your point. Ford wasn't great in the Japan game, though. And I think that probably has come back to haunt him a bit.
But look, he hasn't played for England. How many games for England has he played? And we're expecting him to just be on it. He must have known in the back of his head, well, as soon as Owen's back, I'm out.
I'm on borrowed time. Yeah. But I think the problem is, if we try to play against South Africa the way we played against Argentina, we'll lose every single part of the game.
My concern, or my thinking is that we need to play Japan levels.
Yeah.
100%. Japan style against South Africa. The only thing I'd say about that is that South Africa are miles better than they were in 2015. So that might not work either. I don't know. And there's no way
they're going to underestimate England in the way they probably did Japan.
No, and I don't think there's any way. I don't think there's any way around it. I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that referees are shit scared of doing anything against South Africa. They're reffed very differently. And I know there's been a lot of a lot of bagging of referees in this tournament to varying levels of appropriateness, maybe, but they are definitely refereed differently. They get away with a lot.
How is it that Ben O'Keefe can referee them in the quarterfinals and the semi-final?
And the Ireland game.
Yeah, I really don't get it. Did he do the Ireland South Africa game as well?
Well, it's not.
Yep.
Fuck.
Yeah, so he'll have refereed them which means they know how he's going to referee far better than we'll know, the players, because they'll have seen it and lived it and breathed it.
I mean, I think a lot of the refereeing lacks consistency within the game that's actually going on, let alone across referees across different games.
The referees are fucked. They haven't got a clue what they're supposed to do. I mean, it doesn't help that Carl Dixon is objectively the worst referee I've ever seen at international level. He's absolutely atrocious.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how that wasn't a red card for Argentina on Saturday in the current climate. That's the other thing, is around what constitutes a red card. This whole fucking bunker thing has been an unmitigated disaster, I think, from start to finish. You've got people like Ben Shitehouse and, you know, interjecting themselves into pieces of the game.
Well, this is it, isn't it? There's no consistency over the levels to which these guys are interrupting the game, and that, you know, there's just so much. Oh God, it's hard to talk about rugby without just getting on his back in it, because it's fucked.
Yeah,
really, really, really fucked. Hard. So, how do we see it going at the weekend? Two semi-finals, New Zealand, Argentina, one-way traffic.
I think New Zealand will win it comfortably. They've stuck out without a doubt their best side, and I think they win it relatively comfortably, somewhere between, I don't know, 12 and 20 points. But I don't think it'll be a walkover.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think 12 points is probably about the right point. I thought they played really well against Wales. I was really impressed with Kramer. I thought he was brilliant. But New Zealand, I mean, the breakdown, what they did to Ireland at the breakdown was so, so impressive. And, you know, Kane and Surveyor and everyone else that was involved in that. And it's kind of unbelievable going into a World Cup and no one was talking about New Zealand at all. And it was interesting when Ireland beat South Africa directly after the game. Brian O'Driscoll said a few times he really didn't fancy New Zealand in the quarterfinals. And that sort of that came true. So I think they've got to be heavy favourites. And yeah, like Phil said, 12 to 16, I would say, might be the right call there.
Can we talk about that quarterfinal briefly, the New Zealand Ireland one? Because, you know, not many things have pleased me more in rugby in the last 15 years. I don't think any other team could have done to Ireland what New Zealand did on Saturday. Just out of nowhere. Like, you already alluded to it, Ben. The way they approached the breakdown was amazing. It was so well thought out. It was. And it was, you know, and it was also nice. And, you know, our Emerald Isle counterparts will probably disagree. I thought it was the best refereed game of the tournament. And that's not just because it was Wayne Barnes and an Englishman and Ireland losing. He actually refereed things properly with consistency. That might not have always been the right decision, but it was a consistent decision throughout the match. And he let things go in the breakdown. He let elements of, you know, what may be perceived as minimal release into the tackle before going in for the ball. But that was consistent throughout the game. And that's all anybody really wants.
It's There have been a couple of other really good performances that we should probably highlight if I could remember what they are. So I don't want to say every other game is crap. I think Pierce has generally been pretty good. And there was another couple of games that I thought actually the ref did a really good job there. The standout was the fact that he appeared to be refereeing faults that have been obvious to the rest of us for years particularly well. So Porter's inability to scrum straight. And I know that Alex Corbusier has put out a video saying that he thinks Barnes got one of them wrong. But, I mean, the guy's hips are 18 inches away from the hooker every single scrum.
Well, there was
which
only
is
four
straight
scrums
up penalty,
in the match, so, one there.
Well, yeah. That was mental. Which is also part of the reason why I don't think not having Billy matters. We just need to keep the number of scrums down. But 18 inches away from his hooker every single time, and he's never been pinged for it. But also things like some of the tactics that the Irish use around the rucks that ordinarily they'd get away with and they didn't. I agree with Ben. I thought Kane was excellent, but also so was Surveyor. And
I think that's you know, we haven't really got onto Ireland because I don't think any of us could speak to it for any length of time without
right.
One, laughing and two, getting extremely negative. But I think that's why I think a lot of the Irish vitriol is so funny, because they've just been reffed properly for the first time in about 4 years. Yeah. And they've got the ump about it. But Barnes just told him, "I'm not putting up with your bullshit."
Yeah,
it was great,
and they didn't like it, and it was great.
Watching Johnny Sexton flap his arms about like a fucking seagull every time he was anywhere near the floor. People go on about, and I've said this a lot. People go on a lot about Owen Farrell and his conduct in general. Even on Sunday, some of the Twitter stuff, oh, Owen Farrell trying to referee the game, Owen Farrell this, Owen Farrell that. When Ireland play, not one cunt on Twitter mentions anything about Johnny Sexton. Similarly, Dan Bigger. And they are...
If Farrell had done what Josh Adams did Saturday,
yeah,
Twitter
yeah.
would have exploded.
Yeah. Exactly. And for the record, there was absolutely nothing in that whatsoever. And they should have all have just got on with it and gone, you stop being a prick. You shouldn't have done that. Stop being a prick. Get up. It didn't hurt you. Let's get on with it. But you're right. If that was Owen Farrell, the world would have lost its collective mind. But Johnny Sexton can swan around doing exactly what he wants. And I think the rugby world would be a better place without him. Quite frankly.
Can I shock you? I quite like Ireland, despite what Russ is going to say later. I think the view of a lot of people has been clouded by, on all teams, by rugby Twitter. Just think rugby Twitter is just a sewer, and it's probably about 40 idiots from each country that are just putting everyone off.
Guilty.
but
you
I think,
can't blame me for it anymore. I'm not on there.
Yeah, it has
and nor
been
will I ever be
Ireland
again
team.
Because Twitter have just started charging people to use
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I think it has been a great Ireland team, and they've put in some great performances over the last few years. And the one player I did want to say who's put in an absolute shift for the whole tournament is Bundiaki. He was just great every time I saw him, and he really didn't serve to be on the losing team. But New Zealand just did a number on him, and they were definitely deserved winners in that game.
Yeah, good. Bye, Ireland. Number one in the world. What?
Ciao, baby.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Notice, though, one of the funniest things. Ireland, 99% of Ireland fans have wanked on for however long they've been world number one. The minute they lose a game and drop to number three, world rankings are a load of shit anyway. What a load of rubbish. Piss off. Oh, there you go. England, South Africa, Saturday. Do we have a chance?
No.
Yeah, we've got a chance. I don't think we'll win, but we've got a chance.
It's a small chance.
I think we've what probably got more off? Of a chance than Argentina have.
Be at 8 o'clock. Oh,
8 o'clock.
Yeah.
I'll be having dinner with Matt.
Will you? Oh, yeah. Look at that. That'd be delicious, the pair of you. I would like some nice photographs.
You don't have to say that in front of Ben. Get all upset.
What I will say is, of all the games throughout this World Cup, that first half of rugby on Sunday was probably the best I've watched for quite a considerable amount of time. It was exceptional, and you just got to take your hat off and raise a glass to that half of rugby. And even the second half was very good in a different way, not as extravagant, not as open. Obviously, both teams knew what was at stake, but that just some of the stuff that was played in that first half was electric, and you know, fair play.
How do you feel about that Colby charge down? Because to me,
perfect.
He went early.
I don't think he went early. They say as soon as the kicker once he's planted his feet, the first move, and they say that he breathe in and his chest went up, and that is classed as a movement, and that's when he went.
But if you look on the wider angle, when he did that, his left foot also lifts up, and then he puts it back down again to make his approach. On the wider angle, timing was spot on.
I don't think enough's been made about the fact that that effectively won the game.
In a points differential, it did. France had plenty of other opportunities to do things differently in that match.
Ramos missed another couple of kicks as well, didn't he?
Someone said on Twitter they'd already nearly charged down the conversion before.
Yeah, Reinach went for it.
Reinach got pretty close. They had prepared for that game, and a couple of their tries came off dropped high balls as well, which is something we're going to have to look out for. They've done a lot of prep on a lot of teams, I think. Much as we dislike Rashid, I think they're pretty good at identifying areas to attack.
Areas to attack this England team everywhere.
All of them.
just keep the ball on the pitch.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's going to be difficult, because I think the thing that will wind me up the most if I were to watch it, which I probably won't, would be Joe Marler's "I don't really give a fuck" look when we get pumped by 40 points.
He was dog shit when he came on Sunday as well. It actually, for England, when they started shipping points, they conceded those two tries in 5 or 6 minutes, and they were rocking. They were on the ropes, and it kind of coincided with Marler's appearance on the pitch, Marler and Sinclair. And it was nothing to do with the scrum, but it just, yeah, I don't know. Andy Goode was onto something. Just see him and you won't hear me say that often. Marler and Goode had a little spat on Twitter, didn't they? So,
did they?
Because Goode called him out. Goode called him out for saying basically you're lazy and weren't very good.
Sinclair's an absolute waste of food.
And what was it?
Useless.
What was the reply from?
Do you want two tickets to the semi-final, mate? So
what a cunt!
What a cunt! There we go. Anyway, that's kind of the end of this episode. We may or may not be back at any period of time between now and the end of time. So I just want to leave you very, very quickly with a few words. I'll start with Gordon Darcy, Mrs. Brown, Niall Horan, Roy Keane, Martin McGuinness, Gerry Adams, Jamie Dornan. Feel free to chip in, lads, if you've got any other Irish people you want to mention. St.
Terry
Patrick,
Wogan.
Terry Wogan, Eamon Holmes.
The Edge.
Bono.
Louis Walsh, Laura Whitmore, George Best, Enya. Your boys took one hell of a
Tony
beating.
Cascarino.
Yeah, Andy Tull, all these non-Irish Irish people. Your boys took one hell of a beating, and you are not in the World Cup semi-final. So
Martin Brennan.
Who's Martin Brennan, mate?
The Alan Partridge lookalike from...
Who Eddie... the hell is that?
Eddie Jordan. Oh, there's fucking loads. I wish I could just keep reading them forever. Every single one of them. Liam Neeson, you've been taken out of the World Cup. James Joyce, Colin Farrell, Van Morrison, Brendan Gleeson, Sinead O'Connor,
Will Grigg,
Kenneth Branagh. You can all just get in the fucking bin. Bye now.
The Cause.
Oh yeah, I forgot about The Cause. Stephen Gately, Ronan Keating, Bewitched, all of you. Anyway, go well.
Sports Social Podcast Network.